Okay. Right, this is talk five in the series on how to identify and handle the wicked. So we'll dive straight back into this. So another point to make about the wicked is you cannot rely on appearances. That's the whole point of this. So the wicked may seem to be something. They may seem to be nice, seem to be this, seem to be that. The whole point about it is that the wicked person is not what he seems to be. So do you see the folly of saying, well, he seems to be this? Of course he would seem to be this. That's not the issue. The issue is, what is he really? Because the thing about the wicked is that they seem to be one thing, but they are actually another. And it's central to understanding the wicked to know that they operate in secret. They plot, they scheme, they do things behind backs. And that is what makes them so hard to detect and deal with. Because if the wicked wore uniforms and openly declared themselves to be the wicked, if they were like a gang, a street gang called the wicked, and they wore a certain type of hoodie or something, well then you wouldn't need this training day. You just have to watch out for the hoodie with the wicked written on it. But that's not the way it works. The whole point about it is that they are not what they appear to be. So if you say to yourself, well, this person appears to be this, therefore I will assume they are this, then that is to miss the entire point. The question is, are they what they appear to be? And you can't answer that question by simply restating the point that they appear to be it. So that's the part of the nature of the wicked. They hide their real nature, especially if you're a boss or you're a leader or you're in a position of power or you have authority or you have something to offer. They will do it all the more. And so they'll appear and pretend to be one thing while actually being the very opposite. And so they will act as if they're something, but they won't be it. And you won't discover that sort of two-facedness or falseness unless you check up on them. You've got to do things and take steps to check up on things. I mean, one thing that's a very simple point you can do if you're a boss or a leader or you're involved or a supervisor or you're involved in something is just go out and then come back unexpectedly. Come back at an unexpected time when you weren't supposed to be coming back. Stay outside in the car park and see what's happening from outside. See who's leaving the office early. Look out for things when you're not expected. And these are the things that you will see when you're not expected. When they don't expect you is when they will act in accordance with their real nature. And there are various things you can do to try to increase the odds of catching them at it. Because that's the whole point, is their faults and how they act towards you is not the reality. When I was a boss, I mean, everyone absolutely adored me. I was just loved entirely from morning till night. Everyone loved me the whole time. If I went by appearances, then there would be no book six, would there? The whole point is that book six consists of a sequence of events whereby I discovered that the appearance was not the reality. Do you see? So, Psalm 62:4 says, they take pleasure in falsehood. They bless with their mouths, but inwardly they curse. This is the point. What they say to you is false. It's not their real nature. It's not what they really mean. Jeremiah 9:8, with their mouths they all speak cordially to their neighbours, but in their hearts they set traps for them. And that's another part of it. The wicked person is plotting and scheming to exploit, to undermine, to attack. It says in Psalm 37:12, the wicked plots against the righteous and gnashes his teeth at him. And Psalm 64:2, hide me from the secret plots of the wicked, from the scheming of evildoers. It speaks of, so verse 4, shooting from ambush at the blameless. And it says, verse 5, they talk of laying snares secretly, thinking, who can see us? So it's a feature of the wicked that they're actively involved in plotting, scheming, planning, undermining, sabotaging. That's what they do. This is the point. Now, if you're a godly, honest, sincere, wholehearted, sincere-hearted person, you don't have any plots or schemes. You just are what you are. You say what you mean what you say, you tell the truth. That is totally alien to the wicked. And doing what they do is totally alien to you. But you have to realize that there are people in this world who don't act like you. Because it's the essence of being simple and naive to simply assume that everybody's like you. Do you see the point? Why did God go to the trouble of pointing out that there are four types of person if everybody's the same? Why didn't the Bible say they're all the same? The Bible doesn't say they're all the same. So how foolish can it be to go around assuming that everybody's like you? How could they all be like you? That would mean there's only one type of person. Well, the Bible says there aren't. So, the wicked are not just opportunists who grab an opportunity when it arises to spontaneously do some wicked act. Although they will do that. It's in their nature to plot and scheme against you. They operate covertly behind backs, undermining, plotting, attacking, shooting from behind corners, laying snares, hidden traps. The psalm speaks of that regularly. And I've written book 6 primarily from the perspective of a manager, because that's what I was for all those years. But the essential point about the wicked is they go underground. They operate in the shadows, in the darkness. That's where they're operating. That's how they're operating. Now, another feature about the wicked is they will tend to attack you when you're already involved in some other crisis or difficulty. You'll frequently find it's when you've already got a crisis to deal with, or a problem, or a calamity, or some other kind of difficulty, that they will come out of the shadows. That's because they have a keen sense of timing for opportunity and an eye for opportunity, partly because of their feral shrewdness that we spoke of. They seize the moment when it arises, but also partly because they're demonically guided. The demons tell them when is the best moment. So the demons know what's happening in your life, even if they don't. And you'll find that it's at such times that they will come out and go for you. It's like the saying goes about troubles come in threes. Well, there's a reason for that. It's when that crisis is happening that the demons around you and around them know that this is an opportune moment to go for you. You're distracted, your mind is on other things, this is the time to attack you. And it says in Psalm 18, verse 18, it says, they came upon me in the day of my calamity, meaning they attacked me when I was already in a crisis. So they're like sharks, they can smell blood in the water and they come. And that's when they'll frequently emerge from hiding, and you'll find out at such times who your enemies are. From the way they join in with your other persecutors, or they come against you because they think the time is right to do so. And it says in Psalm 35, verse 15, but at my stumbling they gathered in glee, they gathered together against me. And so they will come out at those times. But also another feature of the wicked is that the wicked take pleasure from other people's misfortunes. You will see this if you're looking for it, if you're out to look for it. If you're not looking for anything, if you have your mind switched off and your eyes switched off and your ears switched off the whole time, you won't see a thing. But if you're looking for it and you see a person taking pleasure from another person's misfortune, it's a clear sign of wickedness. We are not to take pleasure from other people's misfortune, even if they are wicked. So if you see a wicked person and something terrible happens to him, that's not your cue to take pleasure from it, no matter who he is. But where you see a person taking pleasure from a tragedy or a calamity or a terrible situation or a great difficulty that has befallen another person, whoever that person is, whatever they are, and you take pleasure from it, you're gleeful at it, you're enjoying it, that is in itself an indicator. So the person who is responding in that way, that's your cue to form a judgment of that person. Not the one having the calamity or the difficulty, but the one taking pleasure from it. And we see this in particular with the Arab nations. And in the book of Obadiah, it speaks about the people of Edom, in what's now called Jordan, the Arabs. And it says, and God is incensed with them because they gloated over Israel's misfortune. And it says, God is speaking to them through the prophet Obadiah and says, but you should not have gloated over the day of your brother in the day of his misfortune. You should not have rejoiced over the people of Judah in the day of their ruin. You should not have boasted in the day of distress. So where you see that, remember, our theme at the moment is identifying signs and features that help us to identify the wicked. And there are many. And if you become alert to these and tuned into these, you will see them. Just the same as if you went regularly walking with David Bellamy in the countryside, after a year or two, you'd start to spot all sorts of mosses and lichens and different kinds of plants and mushrooms, wouldn't you, that you hadn't seen before. And previously you went out on the same walk and saw nothing. You might have spotted an oak tree, possibly, but nothing else. You didn't see anything else because you weren't looking. All right, some more features of the wicked. Number one, they hate the righteous. And number two, they want to be feared. Okay, and I've noticed this many times. The hatred of the righteous, sometimes even involuntary, unconscious, spontaneous, just it is automatic, it's a reflex. The hate that comes out of them sometimes is known, conscious and intended. Other times entirely involuntary, immediate and unintended, just spontaneous reflex reaction to hate the godly. You see it in the way they gnash their teeth. The psalm speaks regularly of that phrase, the way they gnash their teeth. They don't necessarily literally gnash their teeth, but it's an expression meaning how they are baying for blood, the hatred they feel. If you see that sort of hate, is an indication of the person being wicked. Also, if you see a person who wants to be feared, the desire to be feared by people is another clear indicator of that person being wicked. We are not meant to want to be feared. We're not meant to want to intimidate people. The desire to do so, leave aside actually doing so, leave aside succeeding therein, the desire to do it is indicative in itself, just the desire. And so, the more mature you become as a disciple, the more effective you become. The more you tell the truth, the more effective you become in standing up for righteousness, the more you take God's word seriously, the more the wicked will hate you. And even in the churches, most of the hate I think I've ever received has been in churches, and more so than in workplaces. You will see that intense, irrational, inexplicable hatred if it's based on nothing tangible. Obviously, if you've just killed their dog, then fair enough. But if you've done nothing, if nothing's happened, then it's likely to be explained by the fact that that person is wicked. It says in Proverbs 29:10, bloodthirsty men hate one who is blameless. So the point is Solomon has spotted this. It doesn't say that bloodthirsty men hate one who behaves in a hateful manner, fully justifying hatred. It's saying they hate one who is blameless. They hate your godliness. They hate your honesty. They hate your innocence. They hate your sincerity. They hate your righteousness. They hate the fact that you aren't like them. They hate you just for being godly. But also the wicked are proud and arrogant, and they have a strong desire to be important and to be feared. They want to intimidate others. I think this is more frequently seen amongst men, but also sometimes amongst women. But where there's a desire there for the sheer pleasure of being intimidating to people, where they enjoy it, then that's a real sign that you need to pick up on, because they should not be like that. And the point is, when you see a sign, it's not the sign that is the issue, it's what the sign signifies. So the point is, when you see a sign saying, you know, Dover, 3 miles. It's not the sign that you're. It's not the sign that's important to you. It's what the sign signifies. So when you see something like that, what it signifies is that there is wickedness there, and that wickedness is likely to manifest itself in many other ways. And having seen that sign, you are to say, what can I reasonably deduce from this? What other forms of wickedness ought I to anticipate? I better now get on my guard. I better now watch out. I better now be careful. Because I've seen a sign. The sign tells me something, and I need to be on my guard against the things that the sign is telling me about. Do you see the point? So it isn't just that this one thing exists. So the hatred of the godly, or the desire to intimidate and getting pleasure from it, and that's it. No, it's accompanied by other things. And you must expect to see and find those other things. So take, for example, if the wicked, they want to see people intimidated by them, they will become bemused and alarmed and resentful if someone isn't intimidated. If you're not intimidated by them, they really won't like it. So if a person, and it's often a man, wants to be intimidating and you won't be intimidated by him, he'll find that very unsettling. And the classic example we have of that is Haman. You remember King Ahasuerus and Queen Esther? And Haman is the wicked official who's second in command to the king. And Mordecai, the Jew, refuses to be intimidated by him, and he refuses to fear him or honor him. And look what it says in Esther 5, 9 to 14. In verse 9 it says, "And Haman went out that day, joyful and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai." So he's filled with wrath and anger that Mordecai isn't afraid of him and isn't fearing and trembling before him. Now, for many of us, if we're godly people, assuming that's what we are, we have no desire for people to tremble before us and be intimidated and so forth. No desire for it. The fact that someone does have a desire for it, it not only tells you that they're perverse in that particular, it tells you that they must also be wicked in other ways, and you need to look out for those other ways. That's the whole point of looking for signs. It's not the sign that says 3 miles to Dover that you're looking for. It's Dover that you're looking for. Do you see the point? So when you see the sign, it's not the sign that's the be-all and end-all. It's what does it signify? What else can I learn here? What else do I need to be looking out for? What else is going to be happening here? So another thing about the wicked I've seen consistently is that they hate those who have treated them well. And they do a thing that the Bible calls returning evil for good. So they hate those who treat them well, and they return evil for good and resentment instead of gratitude. So if you do them a good turn, they resent you. Now why? That's irrational. It's completely perverse to the rest of us. We think that's perverse. It's ridiculous. It's irrational. It makes no sense. It makes sense to them, because that's the way that wicked people operate. And where you see it, don't be bemused or amazed or astonished by it. Where you see someone returning evil for good or hating those who have helped them, simply say, "Ah, this tells me something. I've seen a sign. This indicates that this person is doing one of the things that indicates wickedness." It's one of the litmus tests. I call them litmus tests in this book. This is one of the tests that I can use in my laboratory to find wickedness. And you'll find it quite often. It really is typical. And it says in Psalm 109, verse 2 to 5, it says, verse 3, "They beset me with words of hate and attack me without cause. In return for my love, they accuse me. Even as I make prayer for them, so they return me evil for good and hatred for my love." So where you treat them well, they will hate you. And so the wicked hate the godly simply as a species. They just hate the species. But partly they do so because they feel convicted by the godly. And if you're wicked, you have no intention of repenting. And someone comes along who is making you feel convicted, there are only two ways out of that. Where you have conviction, you can either repent, and that resolves the conviction, or you can hate the person who's making you feel convicted. And what a sincere, simple person will do, if convicted, you know, when they're cut to the heart, you know, and the Philippian jailer says, "Brother, what must we do to be saved?" That's what some people do. But the wicked don't say, "Brother, what must we do to be saved?" The wicked hate you. And they hate you because they don't like that feeling inside them of conviction. Because your life itself, your very life, can be a rebuke to them. The mere fact that you exist and you are what you are, they can see it. They can discern what you are. And what you are is a rebuke to them, even though your mouth is firmly closed and saying nothing. just existing as a rebuke. And they see and feel and hear that rebuke, and they hate you for it. And that's partly why they're doing it. And that's partly why you will experience that hatred just for existing. Because the other way they could deal with it is by repenting, but they don't want to. So what do? They have to resort to hate instead, because they need to find an alternative way of relieving that guilt or conviction that they feel. And so they construct a way of justifying resenting you, because resenting you and hating you means they don't have to listen to you. They don't have to repent. They don't have to do as you say. But also, godly people are hated because they simply remind people of God, and these people hate God. So the wicked hate God, and it's natural and obvious, understandable, that they will hate anyone who reminds them of him. And that's what they do. And that's why Paul says in 2 Timothy 3:12, indeed, all who desire to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. Now, why would that make any sense? Why would living a godly life cause you to be persecuted? Living a godly life means you won't cause anybody any harm. You're not going to steal anybody's bike. You're not going to do anything, break into anybody's home. You're going to be a model citizen. Why then do they hate the godly? For those reasons. So, in terms of looking for signs, see the hatred of the godly, the hatred that has no reason, and be guided by it. So, those who do acts of kindness or show mercy and grace are within that group called the godly in the main. If you are doing those things, you're probably within that group, the godly or the righteous. And so the hatred that they feel may be as a result of the kindness you've shown, or it may be just as a result of the godliness that induced you to show kindness in the first place, or it may be because both of those reasons, probably for both those reasons. They're either hating you because you did them good, or they're hating you because you're the kind of godly person who does good. Those are two slightly different points, but it's probably both that are at work. Let me give you an example of this sort of syndrome. There's this woman who used to work for me a long time ago called Sally. When I was a young partner in a previous law firm, she worked for me years ago. And she had a son in primary school. And she just joined us not long before. And she asked if she could book some time off. I was the managing partner at that firm. She asked if she could book some time off for just part of a morning to attend school assembly. She came to me. I was head of the department and I was managing partner. And she said asked if she could have an hour or two off. And I said, yeah, fine. And then it emerged that it was a school assembly where the kid was having to do some kind of drama or something. And it turned out that this was happening every week. There were a series of these things. And so, without being asked, I just said to her, well, would you like to take that hour off every week until the dramas are done, and so you can see them all? And she eagerly accepted that offer. So there it was. It was just a very simple little conversation. She'd asked for something, and I'd given her more than she asked for. I said, well, go and see all of them. Just take every Wednesday morning late, come in late on every Wednesday morning or whatever it was. So that was that. And some weeks later, I think we were just in the kitchen or something, and she came in, and I just innocently asked her, I said, how's the dramas going? And in the course of conversation. And to my surprise, she looked at me with a look of resentment in her face, and there was such a contemptuous look on her face, and a tone in her voice. And she said, this is her exact words, are you expecting me to be grateful or something? I was completely stunned. And this is years ago, my IQ was very low then. And I didn't understand what these things signified. I was totally taken aback. Just completely floored by it. Couldn't believe it. Not only the strangeness of her response, but by the bitterness with which her words were spoken. This is someone I hardly knew. This is just a junior member of staff who had joined some weeks before. And I couldn't understand it. What's the hatred? Why the hate in the voice? And why the animosity? But I think the animosity arose for a number of reasons. Number one, she had a sense of being in my debt. I'd done her a small favour. And she was not willing to let herself feel any gratitude for that. But you see, if you're not willing to feel any gratitude, that creates a kind of turmoil inside you, which you have to resolve in some way. You can resolve the turmoil by showing gratitude or expressing it. Or if you're not willing to do that because you feel hatred, and yet you're feeling that you ought to be grateful to a person you hate, how do you resolve it? You have to persuade yourself that you have some basis for some kind of grievance that justifies withholding of gratitude. You have to resolve it in some way. And that's how they, I think, resolve it. So they construct some basis for feeling that they've been given less than they really ought to have been given, or what you did, though good, was smaller than it should have been, or perhaps that you had selfish motives for giving it. Do you see the point? But what selfish motives would I have for wanting to let some junior member of staff go to school assembly on a Wednesday morning? Why should I care tuppence whether they do or don't go? There's nothing in it for me. But you see, in the mind of that person, they need to persuade themselves that either you did less for them than you should have, in which case, conversely, far from being generous to them, you were being niggardly, or that you only did it for some nefarious ulterior purpose. All of which is ridiculous, but that's what they think. And so the point is this, and this is the point. I had done Sally a little bit of good in a small way, but she repaid me for it with evil, not only by her resentment, but by her intemperate outburst. Now that response in itself, just the response, is a sign which you need to take note of. I didn't take note at the time. As often is the case, I took note later. When later some things emerged that showed that Sally was a real wicked, nasty piece of work. Really nasty she was. But I put two and two together later. So what it was, I got to Dover and then realised what that sign must have been talking about. Oh, that sign must have been talking about Dover. Oh, but you see, I only discovered that when I got to Dover. When I discovered her wickedness, I realized what that must have all been about. If you have a high IQ that's well into double figures, you would look at something like that and think, here is a sign that says Dover, 3 miles. I'm thinking that might mean Dover could be 3 miles. Do you see? And that's what it means to see a sign and respond. So you correctly interpret a sign and respond accordingly. So someone gives you an intemperate outburst and returns evil for good and hates you for no cause whatsoever. It's not that the intemperate outburst in itself is the issue. It's what it signifies. And discernment is about seeing what signs signify. It's like a tongue twister, that, isn't it? Peter Piper Pippi. It's about seeing what things signify. That's what it means. So it's not that the sign itself is the be-all and end-all, but what are you to deduce from it? So wicked people will tend also to despise and seek to exploit those who treat them well. So not only will they hate them, but they'll also seek to use them. If they see that you have done something kind for them or you have been generous to them, they can't understand that. They see it as weakness. They see it as stupidity on your part. They see you as a mug. They don't understand kindness. It doesn't make any sense. And they see it as an opportunity to move in for the kill. And that's how the wicked think. Now, you don't see it that way. If someone's kind to you, nice to you, gracious to you, helpful, cooperative, willing to help, you don't see that as a basis for wanting to move in and attack or take or use or undermine or take advantage of that person. You just are grateful that something really kind has been done. That's not the way the wicked see it. So the wicked see kindness, graciousness, goodness, virtue as weakness and opportunity to move in, to take. That's how they see it. That is just how they see it. So they will despise and seek to exploit those who treat them well. Because kindness and generosity are inexplicable and alien to them. They don't have a place for it in their computer program. It just doesn't make sense. They misinterpret it. And they'll see it as weakness. Decency is weakness. And so you can therefore use this as a litmus test. Where you see people reacting in the wrong way to your kindness and generosity, here is yet another litmus test. Now, let me give you an example of this. There's a couple I used to know years ago called Stephen and Rhoda. That's the names I'm giving to them. And they were, when I helped them, they were in a church I was once part of. And they got themselves into a serious problem with a bank. They'd been in a kind of business. Got themselves in a problem. Only a very small business. But they got themselves in a problem. They owed this bank £18,000 plus potential legal costs. And they were in a right pickle. And I was in the church and I heard of this. And they asked me to help them. So I said I would. And I rang the bank up. And I negotiated with the bank on their behalf. And I got the debt down from £18,000 to £4,500 and no legal costs, whereas they would have had to pay legal costs. So there it is. That's what I did. It took me about 2 months in my own time, just free of charge. I didn't charge them anything. There was just someone in the church and I helped them out. Now, the point was, this is an indicator. They never gave me any sign of appreciation whatsoever. They did nothing at all to thank me. They didn't get me a bottle of wine or a thank you card or anything. I'm not trying to play a violin to get you all weeping and feeling sorry for me. That's not why I'm saying it. I'm just indicating. If you do something for someone and there's no appreciation at all, that is an indicator. It's a litmus test. It's a sign. Why did they allow such a great help to be given to them and not offer any appreciation whatsoever? Answer? Because they don't see it as good that's done for them. They saw it as weakness and stupidity on my part, which afforded them the opportunity to move in for the kill and to make another killing, you see. That's how they saw it. And so Rhoda, in particular, tried to capitalize upon my generosity, or as she would see it, my weakness and stupidity. Because they can't understand kindness. They just don't get it. And what happened was there was a conference coming up for young ladies. And it was going to come up in a couple of months' time. And the thing was, at the church, I suggested that we at the church subsidise this conference for young ladies. And that's what I suggested. Now, Rhoda had a number of daughters and nieces in her family. And she wanted them to go on this conference. Now, this is what she did. She came back. She'd heard this suggestion about helping to pay for this conference, and she came back and said that her daughters and nieces wanted to go on it, but that their 5-seater car wouldn't be big enough. And so she asked if the church would hire a 7-seater vehicle for them to drive to the conference in. Now, all we'd been talking about doing is helping to pay for the conference fees for young ladies to go to it, young, you know, teenage girls to go to. Now, the point is this: she didn't just ask. I think asking was cheeky in itself. She didn't just ask, she was really pushy about it. And she was assuming that I would give way, because she misunderstood. When I helped out with the bank problem, she thought that meant I was weak and stupid and would be a pushover. And so when she wanted to get herself a 7-seater car for the conference, she thought I would just say, "Oh yes, Rhoda, certainly Rhoda, absolutely Rhoda." And that's what she thought would happen. But I wasn't reading out of the script that she had prepared for me. I was reading out of a different script. And I said to her, "Well, I don't think so, Rhoda, not really." I said, "The church is proposing to help pay for conference fees, but not for hiring 7-seater cars to go to the conference in. That's not what we had in mind at all." Now, any decent person faced with that would just accept it graciously. Probably wouldn't have asked in the first place. Nobody was entitled to anything at all. There's no entitlement. But you see, the next thing she did, she went away. And she said, came back to me and said, "Well, they've discussed it as a family and they've decided they want to go to a different conference closer to home." It wasn't for young ladies, it was just a conference about anything. And that was meant to be my cue to just bow to her wishes. She thought she could make me do what she wanted. Bear in mind, by the way, all this is happening in the church context. And I said instead, I didn't go with the script that she was wanting me to read from. And I said, "Well, really, Rhoda, the conference you're speaking of has got nothing to do with young ladies. What we were proposing was something to encourage the teenage girls and young women. And what you're talking about is something else. So that's not what we were proposing to support." And then this is something she said in response to that. So she got angry and irritated. So there she was wanting something, but when she wasn't getting it, she became angry and irritated. Now you need to watch for things like that. She has no basis to be angry or irritated. We have no duty to give her anything at all. She's trying to change all the ground rules. She has no entitlement to anything. So what she said next was important. She said it in an angry tone too. She said, "We can afford to pay for it ourselves. It's not about the money." You see? And that's what she said. Now what I would say to you is this. Take careful note and start to make detailed inquiries if a person spontaneously denies something of which you haven't accused them and which you haven't even mentioned. So if someone's denying something you've never mentioned or denying something you aren't accusing them of, it's significant. What it suggests is this, that the thought or deed that they are denying is actually the very thing that they are thinking or doing. And so you need to be alert to watch out for spontaneous denials or protests, because it gives you a helpful indicator of what the person is really thinking. Because a person has a tendency to blurt out what is actually on their minds. I wasn't thinking, can you afford to pay for it for yourself? Is it all about the money? I wasn't thinking anything. I was just thinking, well, that conference is nothing to do with young ladies. What we suggested was a conference to help the young ladies, not just a conference about something else. That's all I was thinking. But she was thinking that. Now, all I needed to do to get the truth was to delete the word not. So when she said, it's not about the money, the truth was to be derived by simply deleting the word not, and that was the truth. It's about the money is the truth. So she was inadvertently saying the truth to me. All I needed to do was reverse it. So she was spontaneously denying a thing I wasn't accusing her of, but in doing so, she was unwittingly revealing the real thoughts in her mind. And you need to be alert to that, because this happens a lot. And so, another thing that she was doing and thinking was that she was hoping that I'd be worried about offending her. And you'll find that people will seek to manipulate you by taking advantage of your reluctance to offend them, or your reluctance to upset them. Now, obviously you don't want to offend or upset people. Of course you don't. And up to a point, you have a duty to seek not to do so. But the point is this. If a person is seeking to capitalize upon or make use of or manipulate you through your wish not to offend them, that tells you something about them. It is not appropriate to manipulate you through anything or over anything or by means of anything. One of the things that people will manipulate you through is placing you in a position where you might seek to avoid offending them. And in order to achieve that, you will give them what they want so as not to offend them. And she was hoping that I would be induced into agreeing to what she was asking for. This is what my script was meant to be. I was meant to read from this and say, oh dear Rhoda, I wasn't suggesting you were motivated by the desire to get money, of course. What you're asking for is fine. We'll go along with whatever you prefer. And that was what I was meant to say. But I didn't say that. I said, this is what I actually said, pretty much word for word. I said, well, that's good then, Rhoda. If you can afford to pay for yourselves, you can simply go to the other conference instead. Then nobody needs to be consulted at all. Just go ahead and book on to that other conference. Now, my answer was surely a reasonable one. I hadn't offered to fund any conference or other conference. All we'd said, we thought it would be a good thing to encourage the young ladies, underline the word young ladies, to go to that conference, underline the word that conference, for young ladies. And that was it. Nobody was under any duty to even help with that. Even that was just an offer. But we're certainly under no duty to help with anything else. So I was doing nothing wrong in choosing not to help, because she had no valid basis for feeling any sense of entitlement or grievance. But nonetheless, she felt grievance. So she felt grievance at me choosing not to be generous to her. Do you see the point? And she'd also tried to get me to be intimidated by the wish not to offend her. But I've made a pledge to myself, I will not be manipulated by anybody. And if I see anybody trying to manipulate me, I won't do it, whatever it is. And I could see that she was seeking to manipulate me, so I wasn't having it. I had done the earlier thing. I did 2 months' worth of work, you know, intermittently, here and there, phone calls, letters, emails to the bank for them. I did all that because I offered. I said, well, you know, would you like me to do this? And, oh, yes, please, and so on. So that was okay. They'd asked me in the first place, but I'd willingly offered to help. But now something else was happening. They were trying to get stuff out of me because they thought I was a sucker. Now, you see, now, whether I am a sucker or not is not the issue. The point is this. The sign in Rhoda was that she misinterpreted generosity as meaning this. This is a sucker. Anyone that would be willing to spend 2 months helping out intermittently to get my debt down from 18,000 to 4.5 and do it all for nothing must be a sucker. I will move in to get more. Anybody else would have got me a box of chocolates, wouldn't they? But the point is that she thought, I'll go in and get more. Now the point is this, it's what does it signify about Rhoda? That's the issue. And you're meant to be looking for these signs. So what she was doing signified to me a great deal about her. That's the point. And so the thing is, when she had nothing to be aggrieved about, but she nonetheless felt aggrieved. And so she now said she was going to ring Philip. Now, Philip was one of the elders. And she's going to ask Philip what Philip thought. Well, that's fine. I mean, the thing is, they just said they could afford to pay for themselves, and the money was not the issue. If they could afford to pay for themselves and money was not the issue, why do you need to ring Philip for? Do you see? What's the point of ringing Philip up? And also, why speak in an angry tone about this? So I just responded very calmly and said, well, that's fine, Rhoda. Go ahead and ring Philip. I'm simply telling you what I think. Others must judge for themselves what they want to do. And when I said that, there was an icy silence. So I think I was meant to be intimidated by the prospect of somebody ringing Philip up. I don't know what she thought I was, but she must have thought I was an absolute wimp by virtue of having helped. But you see, that's the point. They do misinterpret. And they would think only an idiot would help in that way. Only a nitwit would do that for nothing. Because she wouldn't do anything for nothing. Do you see the point? And she was imputing to me that she was thinking I operated on the same basis as her. And she would think anyone, only a fool, an idiot, would do things for nothing. And so, the thing is, notwithstanding that she had said, it's not about the money, she was then overheard in the kitchen talking to someone at church, complaining angrily that I was against the idea of providing money for a 7-seater. And she was ranting on about this to someone at church. And this chap got out £50 and gave her a gift of £50 to help with the 7-seater. All right? So that's what he did. Subsequently, she didn't hire any 7-seater at all. They didn't use a 7-seater. There was no 7-seater. She never got one. So she pocketed the £50 from this man and took it and never went and got a 7-seater. Do you see the point? Now, she was making the point that she needed this thing. But she took £50 off this man and didn't use it for a 7-seater. But she never returned the £50 to him. She just kept it. So, where are we? Now, another thing about the wicked. Remember, we're looking at litmus tests. We're looking at laboratory testing of the wicked to identify them. It's like being a chemist. You're trying to identify different substances. And you're saying, you're doing tests to see if you can find tests for wickedness. Like looking for cancer. Signs and things that go with cancer. It's like that. Signs and things that go with wickedness. That help you to see it in people. And one thing about the wicked is that they will accuse others of the very things that they themselves are doing. And there are reasons why they do that. But the point is this, you can gain insights and you can be guided by taking note of the accusations that other people make. So you hear person A making an accusation. Person A's accusation, whether it's about you or someone else or whatever, is a useful indicator of what person A is. Not just of what the person is they're criticizing. It's a useful indicator of what they are. And so, why do they do it? They assume, naturally, that others have the same sinister motives and evil intentions that they have. Moreover, the wicked are frequently open in saying so. They naturally impute to others what is in themselves. So you know how I spoke earlier, how the simple, the naive, assume that other people are like them. It's a natural thing to assume that other people are like you. The simple do it, or the wicked do it as well. So the wicked think that you've probably got nasty, horrible, dishonest motives. To them, that's quite likely. They just assume it. And they will frequently assume people have terrible motives or terrible intentions. So sometimes they're lying, of course, when they make accusations, but sometimes they really think it. But they really think it because it's what's in them. And so the point is this. You can gain guidance from the very accusation, because the very accusation will frequently tell you what's in them. Because they will be accusing someone, or you, or someone, of proposing or wishing to do that which they would wish to do. They're accusing you or someone of doing that which they do or would wish to do. And the very fact that they're accusing means that they're imputing their nature to that person. They're assuming that person has their nature. Now, do you see what I mean? If that is what they're doing, the accusation is the guidance as to what they are. Leave aside what the other person is or might be. It's guidance as to what they are. So, as for why they would do it, and why do they make these accusations? Why do they accuse people of doing the very things they're doing? I would identify four main reasons why they do it this way. So we're talking about, why do they accuse you of doing what they do? Number one is to divert attention away from themselves. So if they can accuse person B of doing what they're doing, well, it puts your mind on person B. And if you're naive, your inquiries now will be about person B, and you'll assume that person A has nothing to do with it, if you're naive. If you're wiser, your inquiries will also be about person A. So if an accusation is made against B, you will also include within your inquiries about the person who made the accusation. Number two, why do they do it? Because some of them lack imagination and creativity. And if you want to dream up false accusations, it's hard to dream up false accusations that are all completely invented and imagined. I mean, if you're a novelist or something like that, you could dream up all sorts of things. But most people don't have that creativity or imagination. So what do? They use their own sins, their own motives, their own actions as a ready-made source of accusations that they can level against others. So when they level these accusations, they're very frequently just reaching over here to get their own motives, which are within arm's length. Here's one of my motives. Here's one of my actions. Here's one of my own ways and deeds and things I do, and I'll accuse B of doing that because it lies close at hand. But to have the imagination to think up something completely invented is more hard work, isn't it? It's difficult, hard to do unless you're a novelist or something. And third reason why they accuse people of doing what they do is that it sounds more convincing and coherent. It sounds more real, and it sounds real precisely because it is real. It's an incident from real life. It's just that it's from their life, not B's life. So they take something they've done and accuse B of doing it, and it sounds compelling, convincing, consistent, coherent. It sounds cogent. It sounds to make sense. It does make sense because they did it, and it's exact. They describe it accurately. They define it accurately. It all makes sense. It's convincing because it's real. It's real life. It's much easier to talk about a real life incident than to make one up. Unless you're very clever, completely making things up, unless you have demonic guidance, completely making it up is much harder work and may not be so convincing. And then a fourth reason is what I've alluded to, is that they simply impute to other people their own character. So they're cynical. A wicked person is cynical and assumes that others are like himself. He just assumes it. And they just assume that other people are dishonest, crooked, having all the wishes and objectives and aims that they've got. Now, sometimes they will genuinely believe the accusations they make, as when they're imputing their own motives to others. You know, if they're on the make, if they're on the cadge, if they're on the fiddle, let's imagine they're talking about someone filling in his expenses. They're on the fiddle with their expenses. They think other people are on the fiddle with their expenses. They just assume it. So it's partly that. But it's partly intentional. They know it's false, but they're deliberately making the false accusation. Nevertheless, the false accusation tells you something about the person making the accusation. And you need to be alert to that. So, bear in mind, however, that sometimes the things that people allege and accuse others of are true. So the mere fact that you're alert to what this may tell you about person A making the allegation doesn't mean that you should rule out the possibility that person B is guilty of it. Sometimes they are guilty of it, and you need to allow that as one of the potential outcomes of your inquiry, that the accusation could be real, it could be actually correct as well. That's another possibility, and yet you're still wanting to be alert to what the accusation tells you about A. So the first thing you ask yourself, where an accusation is made by A about B, first is it true? And what you should do about it. And then ask yourself, what does the accusation also tell you about A? Firstly, why is he making it? And secondly, how does he know? How has he managed to find out or discern that which you have not found out or discerned? Bearing in mind, of course, that people's accusations are not always false. The wicked are also skilled at seeing wickedness in others, and sometimes the things they accuse others of are correct. And it may be that they have a motive to undermine or sabotage another person who's a rival or a threat to them in some way. So the thing that B is being accused of may be correct, but it needs to alert you to A. Why is A saying it? There could be several reasons, any one of which might turn out to be the reason, and you need to be open to that. So how did they know? You're wanting to say to yourself, how did they know? Were they manifesting their own feral shrewdness, or was there demonic guidance? Both of which enable them to see things that naive Christians can't see. So therefore, even if an entirely accurate accusation is made by A against B, you still need to say to yourself, how did he know? How did he get the discernment? Where did he get it from? When the rest of us had no idea. Is his discernment due to him being wise and godly, or is he wicked himself? And is he just displaying his feral cunning or the assistance of demons? These are questions you need to ask, whatever might be the truth or otherwise of the accusation. So, I'll tell you what I'll do. I have got about 8 pages left. So I was hoping to get through several more things today on identifying features that enable you to identify the wicked. But I'm going to go on and do a whole bunch more of those things next time. So what I think I'll do is have mercy on the audience today and stop at this point, and I'll pick up. I haven't done as much as I intended to. I'll pick up and do more of this next time in April, plus carry on with more of it anyway. So I'll stop now. That's going to be the end of talk 5.